Hey, everybody, I'm Julie, and I'm an alcoholic. Let's have an AA meeting. I like how y'all started doing that now. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more sobriety tells his or her story.
My name's Tim, and I'm an alcoholic.
This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We have no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. Tonight, Beth BW doesn't stand for Bill Wilson, but she's a big book thumper. She's got about the same amount of time in the program as I do. And I wish that I worked the way she worked. She's got so many sponsees that I see her busy with. She's a major part of our recovery in Gainesville. And thank you for coming down, Beth, and time for you to take over.
Thank you, Tim. I think that's one of the sweetest things anybody's ever said to me. I appreciate that. Tim is a cornerstone of our group in Hall County, too, and he and I do a lot of meetings. I mean, a lot of meetings. I told him tonight, I think this is about 21 in 10 days. I mean, I still have to do a lot of meetings, and it's a pleasure now. I don't have to. It's that I want to. So it's been a day or two since I told my story, and Tim also brings speakers to our group in Gainesville, too. And Saturday morning, he brought Donna P., who has about a million years of sobriety and a glamorous story from California. And, of course, being the good alcoholic that I was, I started worrying about my story. Should I change my story? this alcohol is but a symptom of my disease. Tonight, I want to talk a little bit about, you know, our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now. I want to put a disclaimer out there that when I speak about my childhood, I'll back up to my first drink, but when I speak about my childhood and some things that happened, I don't harbor any resentments today. It's just a part of who I am. It's a part of my journey. It continues to be part of my journey. And if anything, it's given me great resolve in this program. I feel like the next words I say, about half the women that I hear tell their stories say something like this. I was 14 years old when I had my first drink. Seems to be the magical age, somewhere between 13 and 15. Nothing glamorous. I was at Jekyll Island at an Elks Club convention with a bunch of drunk Elks running around. And there was a group of young people, and we swiped a bottle of cold duck. Now, I didn't get drunk that first day, but I did see another fella slide down the wall. But the next words I say, you've also heard, from the moment I took the first drink, I liked it. I fit into my skin. It made everything all right. So let's back up to when I was a little girl. A couple of episodes stick out in my life that, looking back, I know that I was an alcoholic from the get-go. I was probably 6 or 7 years old. I don't know. Grew up in a single-wide trailer in Hall County. Kind of an interesting family dynamic. My mama was from a wealthy family, and my daddy was a poor chicken farmer. And so from the get-go of their marriage, there was a lot of strife. You know, one grandmother wanted me to have the finer things, and my daddy was convinced that, you know, I needed to learn a lot about hard work and hard times. So I always felt a pull between going to grandmother's house and my dad thinking that you know, that's just not the way I want to raise my daughter. So I was in first or second grade, and back in the early 60s, there were still a lot of silver coins around. So my dad had given me a piggy bank, and every time we found silver change, I filled this giant bank with silver change. Well, I went to a school with a lot of kids even poorer than I was, and a lot of kids that didn't have school supplies. And I remember cutting a hole in the bottom of the bank, and I would take out money and take that silver money to school and buy their school supplies, which sounds all fine, well, and good, but it was only later in life that I realized it wasn't true altruism that I was buying those kids. It was that they liked me. Well, the bank emptied. I got a spanking. I couldn't figure that out. I got a spanking. It was my money, and I was given to people who didn't have. Well, fast forward on, things happened in the public school I attended, and my parents plucked me out and put me into a small private school. So here's the little country girl who, I think it was fourth or fifth grade, the teacher said, could you please raise your hand and tell me your favorite flower? I raised my hand and I said, azinia. And everybody looked at me and said, what the heck is she talking about? I remember all those kids laughing and thinking, just because I don't know how to pronounce these words the way that they do, I'm different. So I knew from that time on I didn't fit with the poor kids, or so I was told. I didn't fit with the rich kids, and just nothing seemed to fit for me. So somewhere in middle school, I think I was a majorette, and the girls get mean, like all girls do in middle school, and I quit being a majorette. I remember my daddy telling me, you know what, you're nothing but a quitter. You won't stick with anything. Oh, if he was here today. So I decided to turn that into a passion for study. And that's all I did. I studied and I studied and I studied. But I still couldn't fit in socially. So I found that the magic combination was to study like an animal and party like an animal. And that lasted for a very long time. High school didn't work for me, so I decided if you study hard enough, you can get into college early. So at 16 years old, I left Gainesville and attended Emory University. I cannot imagine letting a 16-year-old off to Atlanta in this day and time to attend college. And I never looked back. Got into some trouble at Emory, as you can only imagine. Grades didn't last, but the partying sure did. Ended up in Washington, D.C., where it took my drinking to a whole different level. I worked for a congressman. I'll just leave out part of that story. Ended up coming back to the University of Georgia with scholarships and graduated with money in my pocket and a degree in my hand. The whole time, I still didn't fit in. I couldn't fit in anywhere. And the drinking got worse and much more secretive. So after graduating UGA, my whole family has been in highway construction for years and years and years. And my dad got cancer, and there were no brothers, there was nobody else to take the business. So I decided that for some reason I'd give up all my studies and my passion and come back home and run the business. Still drinking, and drinking a lot. That same overbearing father that was with me as a child was still with me as an adult. He ended up beating cancer and lived for many years after that. And in large part, I continued to drink more because of the pressure from him. So, like every good Southern girl does, about 25 or 26 years old, I find who I think is the perfect husband, and I get married, and my family were teetotalers. My dad ran moonshine, and I was brought up saying that you don't drink to profit. So I was told that, you just didn't drink, especially if you were a lady. and married into a heavy drinking family. And I think in part I probably did that for a reason, because I did fit in. As a matter of fact, I thought I drank less than they did. The misery continued. Still didn't feel comfortable in my skin. Fast forward, had three beautiful children. Knew that I had a problem when I couldn't stay sober for the 9 months with the second child. Really knew I had a problem with the third child and couldn't stay sober for a day. And that was the beginning of the end. After the third child was born in 1997, by God's grace and the magic of the placenta, the child was perfect. And for the next 2 years, until early 90, I drank every day. Mostly stayed drunk during the day, but still working. In 1990, my husband had had enough. He said, "I'm taking the kids and I'm leaving." And in January of 1990, I said, "Okay, I can get sober." So for the next 90 days, I stayed sober. On day 91, I said, "I got this." And I picked right back up where I left off. April 4th, 3 days later, I said, "Okay, I can do this." And for a year and one day, I stayed sober. So like the classic alcoholic, I told myself, if I can do this for a year, I can do it anytime I want. And I went back out. And 7 years later, I arrived back on the scene. My sobriety date is January 18th of 2008, the most precious day in my life. So my bottom looks something like this. In 2006, my father passed away. That was August. I was dating a nice gentleman. In early 07, the drinking door closed. I went from 5 o'clock to 4 o'clock to 8 to 9, and I was staying drunk all day long. In September of that year, don't know how, he decided he wanted to marry me. In October of that year, I literally went to bed. And from sometime in October till December, I was drinking about a half a gallon of vodka a day. I don't know how I survived it. In early November, I tried to detox myself. I hired ladies to stay with me to keep me from drinking, going through all that in November and December. And in early January, I said, something's got to give. Started looking for places to detox. And then the humorous part of the story starts. So I do all my research and I find the perfect detox facility, and I knew that I needed the grossest place possible. I needed to be in there with the schizophrenics and the psychotics, because I needed a punishment phase in order to keep me sober. And then I asked my angelic little mom to drive me to that place of hell, and so she did. And so I'll never forget that morning of January 18th, we drove up to the facility and we walked in, and I was ready. And they did a breathalyzer on me, and I had the night before decided that I would drink everything in the house, which ended up with two full bottles of Dom Perignon champagne. And so I threw all of that up. So that morning when I showed up, I had a blood alcohol of 0, and they didn't want to take me because I wasn't an alcoholic. So my saintly mama had to put me back in the car, drive to the liquor store. We got a pint of vodka, I threw it back, and off I went. And that is my story. And fast forward to this past December, I had a sponsee that went back out after 3 years. And we went to the same detox facility. And knowing that she had been sober for about 12 or 14 hours, I had to fire a bottle and put her in my car and drive her to detox and celebrate in the parking lot as she threw that bottle away. And I said, "Look, you know, I've been here and I've done that. And it's the last time that you ever have to drink." So what happened? I decided to do inpatient rehab. I knew for me, that kind of structure, it was either going to jail or going to rehab, and I made that choice. And I did it kicking and screaming. So I said I wanted to go, and then when I got there, I fought like hell to get out. I had three children at home. I thought of every excuse possible. But for some reason, only God knows why I stayed. And I did, and I stayed 16 weeks. I got out and stayed sober by the skin of my teeth. I mean, I did the minimum amount of meetings. I worked the steps. I did what I was told. There's a gentleman in our home group at an AA, and I told him just a few minutes ago that I think he scared me sober. He said things like, "Give me 30 days, and then I'll gladly refund your misery." Okay? That same guy also said, you know, it's the steps, it's the steps, it's the steps. I got a sponsor, not because I wanted to, but because they told me to, and at that point it was pretty much life or death. My first 4 or 5 years in sobriety weren't perfect. I mean, I was just sober. Little bits of serenity, but not a whole lot. And then something happened around year 4, and it's probably the major part of my story, is that I reached out to another female alcoholic, and I was willing to be a sponsor, and everything changed. Prior to that, I didn't feel worthy. I didn't feel like I had the sobriety, and I didn't have a program that anybody else would want to work. And this particular person was desperate, and I said, well, at least I can show you what I've done and share my experience with you, and the rest is history. If you're around the rooms in Gainesville very often, you hear me say those 6 words, trust God, clean house, and serve others. The trust in God piece was pretty difficult to me because I remember I keep calling back those days of laying in the bed, you know, drunk, saying, oh, God, please help me. And at this point, I'm even saying, you know, I'm an alcoholic, and I don't get this. You know, I'm asking you for help, but where are you? Only to drink again and more and more and more. So I was one of those people that arrived on the scene with a belly full of religion, but no connection. I mean, I was ashamed. I felt like I had fallen from grace. So rebuilding that spiritual connection was a big, big, big piece of my journey. Cleaning house, trust God, clean house, serve others. It was funny because at 5:45, it was a fourth step meeting. And I had a deep, dark secret. And I whizzed through 1, 2, and 3 pretty well. You know, I knew I was powerless, that alcohol had kicked my booty. I knew that there was a power greater than myself. I just had to figure out how to reconnect that. I made that decision. I didn't have much choice to turn it over. But then we got that powerful fourth step. And I'm one of those alcoholics that, let's take everybody else's inventory. But taking my own was a little different. And so, but I had a deep secret from those days at Emory. I thought it was something that no one could, it was actually criminal. Imagine that. And I had carried that sucker around with me. And I'll never forget, I had gotten it on paper and hid that paper until it was time to do that fifth step. And we were sitting in my sponsor's home in Buford. And I got to that part, and I remember shaking. I just remember shaking. And so then I read out that deep secret of what I had done in college to get out of an exam. And she just died laughing. And I imagine that. I mean, I set something on fire, if you want to know the truth. It wasn't just pulling the fire alarm. I went ahead and lit the fire. So, you know, I've never been accused of going small. When I go big. And she laughed. So as we were talking about that fourth step at the 5:45 meeting, there's not a time that I work with another female alcoholic, and I hear somebody give me their fourth step and a fifth step, and I hear something that I go, ooh, I forgot about that. Oh, okay, you know, and by the grace of God, I can more easily ask for forgiveness nowadays. Nowadays it comes a little easier, a little, sometimes slower. You know, I'm learning more. I love the steps. I mean, I love them. When you hear me talk at home and I share in group, I mean, I love them. They're no longer what I have to do. They're what I want to do. We were talking about defects of character, and so this great, you know, thing happens in my fifth step, and she's laughing at me, and I'm feeling the weight off my shoulders. And then we got to that part that says, entirely ready to have God remove all our defects of character. And I remember thinking, I like these. I mean, you know, what is this going to take away my sexual drive? Am I going? I mean, I remember thinking, I want to be one of them. I like that happy, joyous, and free stuff, but, you know, I like my judgmentalism. I like all that. And then, you know, I had to do my seven-step prayer in little pieces, and I shared in 545 that, you know, that part that says in there, you know, remove those defects of characters that would get in your way of service. Well, I was convinced that I didn't need that area of service, that I'd only ask him to remove those that were causing me trouble. And, you know, today I still have to ask him to remove those defects of character, because they pop back up when they're convenient for me. And that's just part of who I am. And that's part of the reason I keep working with other women, is I have to keep working those steps over and over. And then I'm probably like every other alcoholic out there. You know, I wanted to charge off, especially because what got me to the program besides the bottom was the damage I'd done with my family and what few friends I had left and with my children. And I wanted to rush off and do a ninth step. You know, I just wanted to make those amends. I wanted to say I'm sorry. But when I did, I wanted you to forgive me now. I don't understand. I'm sober. Well, you've been sober about 32 days, and we've heard it before. So, you know, I had to learn that they had to come in order. And then somebody told me about something called living amends. And I still love those. And I still look in my kids' eyes, and I still make them living amends. As soon as I tell people that I live two for one, you know, I'm living 2 days for everyone. I am, you know, I don't regret the past, but I don't wish to shut the door on it. But I lost a lot of good days drunk. Not just a little tipsy, but I lost a lot drunk. So if my day is full of trusting God, cleaning the house, and serving others, I am living two for one. Today, before I came down here, I just think this is so ironic. I laugh. I got a badge. And this badge is from the Hall County Jail. And I'm a qualified member of the AA program at the Hall County Jail. I just have laughed all the way down here. I mean, they should be bringing that meeting to me for all practical purposes. That is just absolutely makes me laugh. And yeah, God does have a sense of humor. My service piece, that's where I want to get back to. Probably about year four or five, my first serious sponsee was an older woman who had health problems brought her to the room. And it was the biggest privilege of my life. And the way that I got this sponsee was I told my story outside the rooms of AA. And if you've never done that, that is a very humbling experience. Because what I'm talking to you tonight, when you start talking about steps and cleaning house and losing your judgmentalism, normal folks would just sort of glaze over. That's something they just don't get. But she came to me after sharing in outside these rooms, and we began working the steps together. And I guess looking, you know, when you look at yourself, or for this alcoholic, when I look at myself in the mirror, I never see the miracles. I mean, I never realize how far I've come or how far down the scale I had gone. But having an intimate relationship where a woman's, it was truly life or death, she did not stop drinking, her liver was at its end, she was going to die. And to see the amount of work that she put in this program, and to see in 90 days' time the turnaround, made it all, like the big giant light bulb went off. She was a miracle. And then all of a sudden I realized, you know, I'm a miracle too. And the program came alive for me. And that's when I ramped up my service. I shared in a meeting not too long ago that, you know, they hustle you. If there's any newcomers in here like less than a year, you're going to get hustled. They're going to hustle you for service. They're going to stick you on a committee. They're going to make you, I guess the old days it was clean ashtrays and do whatever. Well, before you know it, if you stick around here long enough, they're going to stick you on some kind of committee. And they're going to tell you that you got to, it's an important position. And my important position was being secretary of our home group. And, you know, we are still alcoholics. And the chair of our home group had me redo the spreadsheet. He needed me to organize the birthdays and to put everybody's addresses and all that in order. And I remember I was so excited. And I emailed him the spreadsheet, and it wasn't the correct format. Okay? This is my idea of service work. So I emailed it back to him, and he didn't like that either. Third go around, I resigned. And it took me some years after that to realize that, you know, that was me. He was just asking me to do a task. My arrogance got in the way. I wanted to do it my way. And that kept me from seeing the miracles for several years. So today, what I'm like now, I'm still an alcoholic. I still had to do 21 meetings with over 9 years of sobriety. I still get crazy. I still get judgmental. I still get jealous. The book lays out those 7 deadly sins, and you know the first one's pride. And every single time I get wiggy, and I know when I have to do this many meetings, that my pride steps in the way. And part of that goes back to that little girl who never fit in. And, you know, we've all heard that we are egomaniacs with an inferiority complex. Sometimes my egomania shows, sometimes my inferiority shows. And I have to check myself. And usually when my pride gets in the way, that's when I'm feeling so inferior. And I have to puff up. I end up saying things far less than what I used to. But I end up saying inappropriate things, hurting somebody's feelings, and having to go make amends. It's far less today than it has been. Back to the steps. You see, when I first arrived, I thought that, like, you did them, and then somebody gave you an award, and you were fixed, right? I thought that you were cured. Well, my sponsor had a different idea, and so she set me on the course of, you know, we continually redid them. Something happened in September of last year. I disconnected with my sponsor. And for those of you in the program, sometimes, you know, life just gets in the way and it waxes and it wanes. You'll be real tight with the people in the program and then you drift away a little bit. Last summer, I thought that she got busy taking care of her mother, et cetera, et cetera. And then August, I just couldn't get in touch with her. Well, in September, I found out that she went back out. And having a sponsor for 10 years, who had 11 years in the program, was devastating to me. Because it sort of rocked my world, because everything I knew good about this program, I saw in her. I was working with another woman at the time that had 17 years clean and sober. She'd been sober since she was 22 or 23. And one weekend she went back out. And this all happened within a 6 or 8 week time period. And it sort of shook me to the core, because it didn't matter how hard they worked, how hard they worked with other women. For this one woman, she was on a speaking circuit, and how she made a choice one weekend to go back out. I just couldn't understand it. But when both of them came back in, and I also had a sponsee with 3 years go back out, all within this, it just really tore me up. And in talking to all three of them, they're now back in the program, what do you think they said the first thing was to happen? They stopped going to meetings. They stopped going to meetings. Of course, they had all disconnected from me in some way or form, and they all said it's because I was sneaking around drinking. And, you know, I'm glad to be free of that. When we talk about the new freedom and the new happiness, I'm glad to be done with sneaking around. This pocketbook, that big brown pocketbook over there, I laughed yesterday and I told a story about how my now husband thought I was the cheapest drunk around, right? We go to the restaurant and order a glass of wine, but then me and the pocketbook would go to the bathroom. Me and the pocketbook used to be full of little mini bottles. But me and the pocketbook graduated to where I'd have the quart plastic vodka bottle off to the bathroom. You know, when you talk to women, most of us will say, where'd you hide your bottle? Laundry room. We just had a lot of dirty clothes, right? you know, I just don't miss that. I don't miss, especially in the end, waking up to have to try to figure out how I could get sober enough to drive to the liquor store. You know, alcohol was my drug of choice, but I'm sure the insanity for anything else, drugs or anything else, is that same obsession. That's all you think about 24/7. We were talking about the bottles. Another little story. I moved. In 2013, I moved after 20 years in that same house. And this is what makes it raw and real for me. My son had a big oak roll top desk, and it had been modified so that the computer tower would slide in and out of the drawer. So that night, he was 16 at the time, I pulled the drawer out. There was a half gallon of vodka. So for a split second, I said, is it his or was it mine? So I went downstairs, and he came up, and he looked me in the eye, and he said, Mama, one night I had all I could take. This is a lot of years. This is 6 years into my sobriety. I had all I could take, Mama. I poured it out and hit the bottle. Took my breath away. But what happened next really surprised me. Took the bottle. It had a handle, it was glass, and I walked around the house with it for about 30 minutes. You know, they say it's our lover and our best friend. I felt that security of that bottle, and it scared me spitless. My husband walked up, said, I'll take the bottle. We put it away, and I think that night was so powerful. I mean, I don't think there was any way you could have poured it down my throat. But that feeling of warmth and security came back over me, and I knew it was time to step up my game again. So I'm working with other women, I'm doing step work, I'm up in my meeting, but that was a stark reminder that I'm still in love with that bottle. As much damage as it did, it took away a husband, almost took away a business, it took away a home, and I held that bottle with love and affection. This disease is insidious, it is cunning, it is baffling, and it is powerful. And I stand here today, as hard as I work this program, and I can still tell you, I do not know how it works, but it works if you work it, and I still have to work it all the time. Thank you for asking me to speak tonight. I know there's plenty y'all can talk about once I sit down. I tell everybody when I talk to them, if this alcoholic drinking a half a gallon of vodka, and this is what I looked like those last few months, and I'm so vain that I paid a lady to come help with the children, and she would get me up in the morning, shuffle me to the bathroom, stand me in the shower, because I was sure I was going to die, because that's what I wanted, but by golly, I was going to be clean in my pose on the bed. You know, now that's pure vanity, pride, and ego kicking your butt. It was Christmas before I got sober, and she said, would you please get out of the bed and let's walk to the mall? She stood me up. I walked from here to there, and I hit my knees. I mean, that's how far down the scale I had gone. I held that bottle. And I love that stinking bottle after not being able to walk more than 6 feet. Again, it is cunning, it is baffling, and it is powerful. But the only thing that works for this alcoholic is this. Trust in God. Cleaning house all the time. I love to judge me some other people. And that is something that I think I'll, until my last breath, because all that is that little inferiority complex kicking my butt. Working with other women. And I hated women when I got to this program. I see these women go, yes, give me a men's group, and I was right at home. But I have come to cherish my women's group. We're about 50 strong. We meet 3 mornings a week. And, you know, it's changed my sobriety. So at this point, I'll turn it back over to you.
Thank you so much. That was fabulous. I'm judgmental, too. And I'm judging that you're an excellent speaker, so thank you. Thank you. I'll ask Karen to come up and give us.
Hi, everybody. I'm Karen, and I'm definitely an alcoholic, and I don't need to stand that close to this thing. Here, we have a chip system to mark our time in sobriety. The first chip we offer is a white chip, and that's if you went out and got yours wet, or perhaps you want to join us for the very first time. Pick up a white chip. We have silver for 30 days. Anybody else for a silver chip? Okay. We offer a red chip for 90 days. All right. Anybody else for a red chip? We offer yellow for 6 months. Okay. Green for 9 months. And blue for years and multiples.
Hey y'all, I'm Tinsley. I'm an alcoholic. And it's an honor to be asked to give out a medallion, a birthday medallion to somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a real honor. And tonight I'm honored to give my friend Julie her medallion. And Julie tells it like it is. And she does the deal. People who do the deal get the benefits. And the benefit is twofold, sobriety and happiness. So I'm not going to tell you what she does, but I'm going to give her a medallion and tell her I love her very much.
Yes, I'm Julie. I'm an alcoholic. And this is number 22. And like Beth just said, I have no idea how that worked, how it happened. I just know that I followed the directions. I became a human being. It was great because before I was came in here, I was either subhuman or superhuman. Now I get to just be human, and I really, really appreciate that because that makes me able to go outside and be in society with the rest of the humans. I was unable to do that. To me, meetings are very, very important, and working with other people and making sure that I'm in touch with an alcoholic every day in some way. I do still go to a whole lot of meetings, not because God gave me all 24 hours back. I say that all the time. I spent so much time drinking, planning drinking, getting over drinking. Having 24 hours in a day is just such a gift, and you alluded to it too. What else, go to a meeting for an hour a day, that's no big deal. And then, I just go to them because I love to go to them now. Because I love all of you very, very, very much. And you are very instrumental in keeping me sober on an everyday basis. So, thank you.
Anybody else for a blue chip? No? Okay. Can we offer the white chip just one more time? Because we are all worthy of a second chance. Thank God for the chips you hold.
I also keep coming back to meetings because I hear something new every single time. I never heard that if you went out and got your white chip wet. I like that. And I've been to thousands of AAB. I hadn't heard that one. Thank you one and all for joining the Blue Chip Speakers meeting tonight.
Just another homesick child, tired of running wild, ready to stand trial and move on. Though I'm guilty in your sight, ask for mercy tonight. I can't make it through this fight all alone. But oh Lord, don't make it easy. Keep me working till I work it on out. But please, please, won't you shine enough light on me till I'm free from the shadow of doubt. Keep me out of the shadow of doubt. As I try to make some sense of this world I'm up against, well, I know my best defense is your love. When the struggle gets insane and the lessons fall apart, keep me calling out your name with love. But oh Lord, don't make it easy. Keep me working till I work it on out. But please, please, won't you shine enough light on me till I'm free from the shadow of doubt. Keep me out of the shadow of doubt. From the bottom of my heart, and I'm searching for one star to shine. I will shout for mountain high, and I'll reach into the sky till you open up my eyes so blind. But oh Lord, don't make it easy. Keep me working till I work it on out. But please, please, won't you shine enough light on me till I'm free from the shadow of doubt. Keep me out of the shadow of doubt.